The headlines again. The COVID-19 public inquiry has been told that government decision-making during the pandemic was undermined by a toxic atmosphere and factional infighting. Rishi Sunak has insisted he will not be forced into making a premature decision about the future of the HS2 high-speed rail link between Birmingham and Manchester. NATO has warned it's running out of ammunition to send to Kiev, with members being urged to ramp up production. A review has found that some Police Scotland officers have no vetting record. An employment tribunal in Leicester has begun hearing a case where, for the first time, symptoms of the menopause are being viewed as a disability. BBC News.
With Jane Steele. We're celebrating all things medical next, from cancer-curing micro-bubbles to life-enhancing dancing. Kerry Pritchard-McLean is joined by funny and fascinating comedians, doctors, scientists and historians to salute medicine's inspiring past, present and future. Best Medicine is next.
Well, here we are again. It's been a minute now.
Cillian Murphy's limited edition is back.
Music was definitely my first love.
A nocturnal playlist with music hand-picked by Cillian Murphy.
I've been listening to an awful lot of music since we last spoke. So there'll be new stuff, there'll be old stuff, there'll be weird stuff. As well as some very beautiful, serene music. And some proper euphoric music. It's like pure sonic joy.
Cillian Murphy's limited edition. To listen, just search Cillian on BBC Sounds.
Now here on BBC Radio 4, a new series, Best Medicine. Kerry Pritchard-McLean is joined by comedians and experts to dissect funny and fascinating medicine.
Richard McLean, and welcome to Best Medicine, the show that celebrates medicine's past, present and future. Now, as a stand-up comedian, I know that laughter is the best medicine, especially if the condition is absent parents. She won't like that when she listens. She won't listen. My four superb, fascinating guests are each going to make a case for what they think is the best medicine. Whether it's world-changing science, an everyday treatment, an obscure invention, or an unsung hero, we're going to slice them open, stick them under the microscope, and work out which is the best. So let's meet our panel. Dr. Lindsay Fitzharris, Professor Mark Wilson, Professor Eleanor Stride, and comedian Darren Harriott. Darren, did you ever feel like you could be a doctor?
Yeah, I have. There's a TV show called Doctors, and I went for an audition to play a doctor. But the thing about me is I can't act.
I don't think that will stop you.
Yeah, terrible. And I had to tell someone that their wife had died. That was the line. But my problem is I don't know what to do with my hands. Then I went, last night your wife died in her sleep. And then I just started rubbing my chin. The guy who was doing the audition went, why are you rubbing your chin? And I got so defensive, I went, doctors have chins.
Dr. Lindsay Fitzharris is a best-selling author and historian. Her latest book, The Facemaker, is about the pioneering surgery that rebuilt soldiers' faces during the First World War. Amazing. So, Lindsay, I see you've brought some props with you. That's going to work well on radio.
Yeah, I have my macabre Mary Poppins bag. And actually, you know, I bring all these medical history objects around, and I always feel like objects are a really good way into the past. And one time, I'd had a few drinks with my friends, and I was running to get the train, and I got onto the train, and I tripped, and a skull came tumbling out of my bag. But everybody was really British about it, and they kind of like looked away, they're like, oh, how embarrassing, she dropped her skull, you know?
I think if a skull had fallen out of my bag on the train, I would just immediately be like, that's what happens if you use your phone in the quiet carriage. Now, Eleanor, according to this, your job title is Statutory Professor of Biomaterials in the Departments of Engineering Science and the Nuffield Department of Orthopaedics, Rheumatology and Musculoskeletal Sciences, specialising in biomedical ultrasound and the fabrication of nano and microscale devices for targeted drug delivery.
Park life!
Yeah. David Attenborough has actually listed Eleanor's business card as the leading cause of global deforestation. Do you work in a lab then?
I do work in a lab. Short version is I sit between the departments of medical sciences and engineering. My short title is actually the chair of biomaterials, but that sounds like I sit around on something squishy all day, which is not ideal.
I love that. Right, now, Mark, you've got a few jobs. You are a professor, an air ambulance doctor, and you're a brain surgeon. I think you know the cost of living crisis is getting out of hand when even brain surgeons are starting to have a second job. Mark, is brain surgery as hard as everyone says it is?
There's relatively simple stuff that's like removing blood clots, which has a big impact on people, saves lives. And then there's really highly complex surgeries, which is terrifying.
I love that you've just passed off removing a blood clot as relatively simple. Now then, Eleanor, let's start with you. What do you think is the best medicine?
Bubbles.
Okay. You're not just talking about the ones that, like, kids blow or bubbles for washing hands.
I kind of am, but really, really tiny. So ones that you can safely inject into the bloodstream without giving yourself the bends. And the idea, we can trap drugs in these very tiny little bubbles. They can go into the bloodstream, and then we pop them open where we need the drug to be delivered. So we can reduce the dose by about 100 times. So for really, really nasty treatments like cancer chemotherapy, we can hopefully massively reduce the side effects.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
So nice to hear science getting around a bit.
So that's amazing. So you put the drugs inside, but what are the bubbles made of?
So it really is like a tiny soap bubble. And then around the outside, we've got, it's the same material all your cells are made out of. So this is a biological surfactant. So it's basically safe washing up liquid. So we extract it from either from eggs or from olive oil. So that goes around as a shell, and then we trap the drug inside. In order to destroy them and get the drug out, we've got to use something. And the thing we use is ultrasound. Because we can focus it really tightly, we can control exactly where that drug gets delivered.
Oh, my God. This is incredible, isn't it?
Oh, you guys are going to be so let down by mine.
So you're sort of aiming to cure cancer by mixing, like, olive oil and washing up liquids. I feel like you must be due a Blue Peter badge by now. Like, surely.
Is it just cancer?
No. So we're delivering chemotherapy drugs. We're also making a big project on antibiotics, because I'm sure most people know antimicrobial resistance is really, really terrifying.
Wow. Yeah, in the green room, we were talking about super gonorrhea, weren't we? Yeah. That's
don't ask why.
I could tell you a lot about, like, weird diseases that have disappeared, but we're going to start seeing some of that stuff come back because of antibiotic resistance.
Tertiary syphilis, it's coming.
It's coming. Your nose is going to fall off. It's terrible.
Oh, my God, that's like the reverse of the Coca-Cola Christmas advert. Tertiary syphilis is coming. Tertiary syphilis is coming.
Super gonorrhea.
So how do you control the size of these olive oil bubbles?
Well, the way we make them is slightly embarrassing because it's basically a cappuccino machine. It really is. Wow.
You need more funding.
Yes, we do.
So you get the bubbles in the right place. How do you get them in the right place, though?
Oh, so they just go into the bloodstream, so they're swimming around, but because the drug's inside the bubble, it doesn't do anything. But we can focus ultrasound down to about the size of a grain of rice. So one of the things we often need to do is we just bung a load of rust, basically, iron oxide nanoparticles into our bubbles. And that means we can use a big magnet and just, corral them all in the tumour before we fire the ultrasound. These are very, very powerful magnets. So we've got, it's about the size of an iPhone, but it can pick up a car. So you do have to be a bit...
Whoa! That's cool!
You have to be a bit careful in the lab. When it goes wrong is when you forget that all sorts of other things are magnetic. Oh. A very eminent professor at Imperial College and I were doing an experiment together.
What, did he have, like, a Prince Albert?
I've got to give a talk at this guy's inaugural lecture on Wednesday and you've just spoiled it.
Does it make a difference to people with untreatable cancers as well?
Well, we hope it might. So there's a couple of things. First of all, we can use this to actually reduce the size of a tumour. So it could be removed by surgery, because often the reason is tumours are just too big when they're diagnosed. The other really cool thing that we're only just starting to understand is when we pop, implode the bubbles. They seem to stimulate the immune system, and that's really, really exciting, because the immune system is the one thing that can actually cure cancer.
Wow.
So if cancer does something really, really horrible, it sort of plays a Jedi mind trick on the immune system. So the immune system recognizes that, you know, this thing should not be there. The cell has become malignant, but the cells secrete molecules that switch it off. If we can switch those back on, and this is the whole field of immunotherapy, that's really cool. And it looks like something we're doing with the bubbles is that. So, I mean, it's a little way off, but that's... We hope we're a couple of years off doing something with standard chemotherapy, which we hope for pancreatic cancer, which, again, is currently often a death sentence, and we hope we might be able to change that. The immunotherapy work's going to take a lot longer, but I hope, you know, within the next 10 years, we'll be getting a lot of these things into the clinic.
Amazing. Absolutely incredible. Eleanor, everybody. Well, thank you, Eleanor, and good luck with your absolutely incredible work. And just for the listeners at home, we've actually provided Eleanor with some pipe cleaners and a half-eaten packet of Monster Munch. We're going to check in with her later when hopefully she's cured Legionnaire's disease. So, okay, Darren Harriot. Eleanor is curing cancer. What's your best medicine?
Dancing. Okay, I'll give you a little history about me. I was a very obese kid. Okay. Doesn't normally get that, but I'll take that. I never liked the idea of my body or moving my body in a certain way. I always keep quite stationary. Even when I do stand up, I sort of stand still. So I decided to change things and get a bit more comfortable in my body. So I started last year. I do Latin dance, sort of. Yes, you can always tell if you're a confident dancer if you're willing to sort of lead a conga line. Not me! Not me, I'm in the middle. I don't want to be at the end either. Too much pressure, right? Stay in the middle. I'm the sort of person who doesn't, I don't really like mirrors. Not a big mirror guy. I've got like one mirror in my house, but I walk past it as if like I owe it money. You know what I mean? But doing dance, there's like a giant mirror and you have to watch yourself. And sometimes, I'll be honest, I'm gonna die. I look at myself and go, ill. But over the months, I've been watching and I can see there's more progression. It's really changed my life and made me feel so much more confident as a person, because I feel like for a lot of us, we take that for granted. It's that whole thing of dance like nobody's watching, but do it in a room where there's loads of people doing it as well.
So do you think it helps your mental health as well, then?
Helps my mental health completely.
There was a dancing plague in the 16th century. Well, there was like dance mania in France, and they were all dancing. It all started with a few women dancing, and then everybody started dancing, and then nobody could stop dancing, and doctors were brought in, and people were hospitalized, and allegedly people died, like mass hysteria. And it went on for weeks. Like, just imagine, like, people were just exhausted. They just kept dancing and dancing.
That just sounds like a Birmingham raise.
Yeah. Listen, I was actually about to join you and say, can I join you on dancing as the best medicine? Because I'm completely addicted to swing dancing. I couldn't get through. It's the ultimate mindfulness.
Yeah.
It's absolutely
really?
Amazing. I have a prescription for dancing.
Really?
Yeah.
So I'm about to bring the mood down horribly. So I was diagnosed with cancer in 2017, which came as a bit of a shock. You don't want to get the thing you work on. Yeah. Not least because when you go into hospital, you know everyone. Mm. But actually, luckily, it was all fine, thank God. Surgery quickly. I had to do a little bit of chemotherapy, which was grim. This is why I know we need better ways of delivering it. But yeah, when I was discharged, the very senior consultant I went to see said, right, what do you like doing? I said, dancing. And he said, fantastic, right? It's exercise, it makes you happy. And he wrote it down on my prescription. Oh, so I have a prescription for dancing.
That's so lovely, isn't it? Isn't that, again, so nice?
Honestly, I've been doing stand-up now since I was a teenager. I became obsessed with stand-up as a teenager, and I was very depressed and very sad about my life, losing my dad, all this sort of stuff, blah, 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 blah. Anyway.
That sounds like it's been resolved.
I did start therapy as well.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. I started therapy, I think just before I started dancing. And it's been interesting. We've had lots of breakthroughs. Obviously, there's lots of stigmas around sort of therapy, but I think especially when you're a comedian, you always feel like, oh, the stage is my therapy, man. But I realise that when you have to have a laugh at the end, a ha-ha, you don't really learn anything from it, because ultimately you're talking about these things, but then you're just trying to get to the laughter part of it. So I started doing therapy, and it's been really nice. The only downside is she doesn't laugh at my jokes, man. She goes, mm-hmm. And that is the worst
brutal
thing you want to hear after a joke. Second only to, like, a gunshot.
Or the sound of Will Smith's feet coming towards you. I think that's amazing. Because we've known each other a long time as well. And you do seem like you're in a better place than ever.
Yeah, definitely. I think, for me personally, just taking a bit of the stress off the old career and just focusing on trying to have fun a little bit more and sort me out. It's really worked out. Oh. God, that's not very funny though, is it?
No, it's okay. It's lovely. It's absolutely brilliant. And also, like, you're not the kind of person people expect to be so open about mental health and things like this and therapy. And I think you saying that will really help other people. Because I think therapy is like, it's like washing up, isn't it? Like, if everyone just did a bit, life would be a lot better, quite frankly. Okay, Lindsay, what do you think is the best medicine?
I think the best medicine is masks. I just wrote a book called The Facemaker, which is about the pioneering surgeon Harold Gillies, who rebuilt soldiers' faces during the First World War. He's like the grandfather of plastic surgery. So World War I, there were so many facial injuries. Men were burned, they were maimed, they were gassed. Some were even kicked in the face by horses. Before the war was over, 280,000 men from France, Germany, and Britain alone suffered some kind of facial trauma. So there's this huge need.
So this picture we're looking at here, so there's a picture of a gentleman who's got a really badly damaged face.
Yes.
And then is it the same guy?
It is the same guy.
But it looks like his face is completely...
That's a mask. That's a mask he's wearing. So these artists created these wonderfully rendered masks. Now, whenever I post these images on social media, they kind of tend to go very viral because they are startlingly realistic.
What were they made of?
It was a metal that they beat down into a very thin kind of wearable metal over the face. Now, the thing I always like to remind people of is that they were fragile, they didn't age. And so for a lot of reasons, they weren't a long-term solution. And I also just want to remind people that these men were wearing these masks for you so that you didn't feel uncomfortable looking at them.
Oh, and so basically this is a very artful way of dealing with like ableism, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, these men were forced to sit on blue benches so that the public knew not to look at them while they were undergoing reconstructive surgery. And Harold Gillies, you know, he hated the mask makers on a certain level because it reminded him of the limitations of what he could do as a surgeon because he's like making all of this up. Plastic surgery sort of predates World War I. In fact, the term is coined in 1798, and at the time, plastic meant something that you could shape or you could mold. So in this case, it was a patient's skin or soft tissue. That's what plastic surgery meant.
This feels too mad, but I heard that they had cartoonists help design them.
Well,
but then I'm just like, where's their oversized skateboard? I know.
One of the men that Gillies brings onto his team is Henry Tonks, and he is an accomplished artist as well as a caricaturist. Artists were so important to helping Gillies visualize the whole face and, you know, if you move something here, what's that going to look like? Do you lose the likeness of someone? So the artists are really important to what he's able to accomplish. And I think that it reminds me of the power of science and art. And when those things merge together, they can do amazing things for patients.
I feel like in some ways we haven't necessarily move forward because you still have it in like films, right?
That absolutely.
When they want to show someone's a villain, they usually give them some kind
There's so many. There's Darth Vader, there's Voldemort, there's Harvey Two-Face, who becomes evil once he's disfigured, guys. Like, he's a good guy when he looks good, and then he's... And I would love to see these, you know, disfigured soldiers as the heroes of their own story because they absolutely are.
Lindsay, thank you so much for opening our eyes to masks from history. Mark, it's time for you to tell us the best medicine before you run off and go and get another job. So, Mark, what do you think is the best medicine?
It's a platform called Good Sam, and it's a way of delivering care in a new kind of way. Well, this goes back a few years now when I was doing a lot of air ambulance work, and we found that we were going to quite a lot of people who have a head injury and lose their airway, or they would stop breathing. And what we wanted to do was try and alert people who are nearby who could go and hold an airway open whilst the ambulance service is en route. This has a big role in trauma, but it has a much bigger role in cardiac arrest, because if you have a cardiac arrest on the streets of London or in most places now, your chance of survival are around 9%.
Wow.
But if you have a cardiac arrest in an airport, like Heathrow Airport, your chance of survival are around 80%. The difference is the time to getting CPR done and a defibrillator, which is at every other gate, and all air crew are trained in basic life support. So could we use technology and community crowdsourcing for cardiac arrests?
What about if you're not liked in your community?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the system we've set up doesn't actually tell you who it is.
For that reason, yeah.
It's a system that alerts people who are registered on the platform, who are off-duty, doctors, nurses, paramedics, policemen, firemen, people trained in CPR, and they get alerted by the ambulance services to wherever that person is who's having a cardiac arrest.
I think we have the noise that the app makes.
Yeah, it does tend to wake you up.
So that will go off and that will alert someone who's first aid trained?
Yes, so they can make their way there and often be there much quicker because they're only around the corner.
Yeah.
So they can be there way before the ambulance gets there. And for every minute you start doing CPR earlier, chance of survival increase by 10%.
Wow.
So every minute really does count.
So basically, as I think it is, mm-hmm. Is it like Uber for CPR?
It is a bit like that.
So you would have this app on your phone. And do you have this app on your phone? Or you're like, not for me?
No, Well, I do have this up on my phone. So basically, if you've done first aid training and done CPR as part of that, you can upload your certificate and be on the platform.
But how do you know? How does somebody sort of use it?
Normally, someone's dialed 999
yeah.
in those circumstances, and they've said certain words which are likely to be or become cardiac arrest. So things like not conscious, not breathing. And so that will get alerted. For example, in London, it'll get alerted about 40 times a day, of which about 20 to 30 are cardiac arrests.
I did a bit of CPR. Training. I think it was the Anidolt.
Yeah, it was the Anidolt. Yeah.
Yeah, that was weird.
It's weird.
Because we did it in school.
I have a bit of a creepy fact about that doll.
Of course you do.
Yeah, of course. You know, that's why I'm here. So that the face of that doll is based off a real person who died in, I believe it was in the 19th century. And she drowned. Nobody knows her name. And this was in Paris. And at the time, you could go into the mortuary to identify bodies. Like, it was a day out and people would go. And anyway, so people were commenting on how beautiful and mysterious her smile was. She had this kind of faint smile on her lips. A death mask was made of her face. And later, when the CPR doll was being created, the person who created the face for it, he knew about this death mask, and so he based it off of her face. So this woman who drowned, that we don't know her name in the 19th century, is resuscitated many, many times over through the teaching of CPR every year, which is incredible.
Yeah, but also a load of kids from a school in Birmingham have a go on her as well. This is why, as women, you should never smile.
I think I'm going to be CPR trained. Just hearing you speak and how much it makes a difference to save lives.
Well, there's another side of it. So what we've talked about there is the app-based element of it. But there's another bit of the platform which is plugged into the ambulance service and police services now that enables the 999 call handler to open up anyone's mobile phone cameras with their permission. We can be instantly on scene through other people's hands and manage patients. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you're using the cameras like a set of eyes on the scene.
Yeah, and not only just can you see what's going on, but you can guide people through that life-saving care.
Okay, so we're going to do a bit of an act out now.
Okay, so I'm going to play the ambulance dispatcher here.
Okay.
And you've dialed 999. Don't dial 999.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
We're pretending you have dialed 999, and I'm saying, Kiri, it'd be really handy if I could see Darren, who you're trying to describe to me here.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you a text now. When you get that text, can you click on the link? It's going to ask to share your location data and your video data. Could you say yes to everything for us? And you've got it then, you've said yes.
Is it so you can see my boobs? Because I'll show you for free.
Okay. It only lasts for 15 minutes in terms of the...
I can do it in that.
So I can see where you are. I can see you're in Marylebone there. And I can also see you.
I think it should come with a health warning that the camera is going to come on facing your own face when you first open it.
So what you're also seeing there is, if you look at your face on there, it'll measure your pulse and respiratory rate. If you just hold it this way on there, you see it's got a box around your face there, it'll find your face, and then after about 20 seconds, it'll measure your pulse, well, not even that.
Whoa.
Your pulse rate there of 67, respiratory rate of about 15. And so we can get vital signs.
How does it take your pulse?
So there's all AI, sort of things like skin colour and other things to...
I've got so much makeup on. This is absolutely amazing, isn't it? This is incredible.
And it means we can see diseases at a time when we never normally get to see them. We're not normally there within a minute of a trauma or a minute of a cardiac arrest. So we get to see the very early pathology that we're not used to seeing.
Please don't diagnose me with anything off this.
Super gonorrhea.
This is amazing. Before we finish, I think we have got someone in the audience who wouldn't be here with us tonight if it wasn't for the Good Sam app. Mick, are you here, love?
Yeah, here.
Hey, Mick. Hi, nice to meet you. Wow. So what was your experience with the app, Mick?
Very positive. Yeah, so basically I had a cardiac arrest in my kitchen. My other half, she and my daughter decided to phone 999 after a few minutes.
Yeah.
When I was just laying there.
I just carried on cooking.
In the meantime, I'm dead and unresponsive on the floor. And that's, well, numbers up, really. And then all of a sudden, someone knocked on the front door called Innes. Like, said to my daughter, I'm here for your dad. And she says, well, where's your ambulance? And he said, I don't need an ambulance. I only live four doors down.
Oh, my gosh. So someone who lives, like, four doors down...
Yep.
...came over and saved your life?
Yeah.
Wow. That is absolutely amazing.
Do you send them a Christmas card?
Every year. Yeah. It'll be the second year this year, so... Wow.
Do you remember, like, what happened when you came round?
No, I just said, un momento, por favor.
So you speak Spanish?
No, I can't. That's the first thing.
So he CPR'd you into bilingualism? What?
I think he did.
What an absolute... So did you know him before this?
No.
Oh, my gosh.
It was the first time I met him in 12 years, and that's how long he had been there, so...
Did you go over and thank him?
Yeah, that was the hard part. I sort of broke down... as I got towards his house, and then a few deep breaths, and then knock on the door, and he sort of answers it and says, how are you? And you're like, yeah, well, alive because of you.
It's amazing.
And it is always amazing to hear of people who have survived through the system. The fact that, as Mick said, they didn't know the neighbour a few doors down the line, that's so much the case, sadly, as the world is today. Mm. And this is a system that's trying to recreate what we used to have of everyone knowing each other and being able to support each other.
Thank you so much to Mick. I'm so glad you could be with us tonight because of Good Sam. So give it up for Mick, everyone. Well, thank you very much, Mark, for telling us about your incredible app, Good Sam. It's a miracle, not only because it saves lives, but because you're a man who's working on an app right now, and I don't want to punch you in the face. But you have made me feel a little guilty about describing the Deliveroo app as a lifesaver for the past 6 years. Now, this is a really difficult part of the show. I have to choose what is the best medicine. Is it cancer-curing bubbles, life-enhancing dancing, miraculous masks, or the life-saving Good Sam platform? This is so hard, isn't it?
Bubbles.
I think the bubbles. Right, listen, here's my logic. Here's my logic is the bubbles is amazing, but it's not finished yet. Whereas yeah, this app, we could all have on our phones. It could save anyone in this room's life now, today. So I think this week's best medicine is the Good Sam platform.
But the amazing thing is that all the different breadths of medicine that have been covered here have all got their really important component for the person that's the other end of it, the patient. It's all one of the
it's
same thing in medicine.
What you say to the losers, it's the consolation prize. That feels...
You're all winners. Mark, if you could back off being worthy for 5 seconds. To our amazing panel, and we've got to wrap things up now because Darren's off to Geneva to pick up his Nobel Prize in dancing. Thank you very much. Good night. Best Medicine was hosted by me, Kira Pritchard-McLean, and featured Dr. Lindsay Fitzharris, Darren Harriott, Professor Eleanor Stride, and Professor Mark Wilson. It was written by Jordan Gray, Rajiv Carrier, Kira Pritchard-McLean, and Ben Rouse. The producer was Ben Warsfield, and this was a large time production for BBC Radio 4.
And you can get a regular dose of Best Medicine on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds every week for the next 10 weeks. And there's more comedy right now over on 4 Extra with Jenny Eclair, Hugh Dennis and Greg Proops.
The World Tonight, a news programme for people curious about the world and Britain's place in it.
Reaction from across the board internationally seems to be one of concern.
We come to you at the end of the day and we try to be a calm, reflective place where you can perhaps take stock of the events of the day, but take stock from a global perspective.
Does this change the relationship?
What are the politics of this? Why now?
We do try and put into context what's happening here in the UK.
What did you make of the announcements?
The World Tonight, every Monday to Friday night at 10 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
After the news, Oliver thinks he's found a solution.
BBC News at 7 o'clock. The COVID-19 public inquiry has begun its second stage, examining the government's handling of the pandemic, with accusations of chaos at number 10. Today's session focused on the days leading up to the first national lockdown in March 2020. The lead counsel to the inquiry, Hugo Keith KC, said a diary entry from the UK's chief scientific advisor at the time, Sir Patrick Vallance, painted a negative picture.
In any event, the WhatsApp messages between Messrs Johnson, Cummings and others betray a depressing picture of a toxic atmosphere. Factional infighting and internecine attacks on colleagues.
The Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has used her speech to the Conservative Party conference to say that politicians have been too squeamish when it comes to tackling migration. She said the government would soon start closing asylum hotels. She also announced a plan to ban sex offenders from changing